The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking levels, adjusting camera, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right. Well, welcome. Oh, wait a minute. We got no audio. Why do we have no audio there? Something really, really funny. Here we go. Okay. Audio now on YouTube. Hi, YouTubers. I'm having one of those days. You know, the gremlins have been invading this, and there's no good reason for it, but my Ethernet is out on one of the computers. Hopefully it won't affect us in the least. Knocking on wood laminate here. So we have, I have a great interview for you today. And as I, we taped it at 11 this morning just because it was better for the guest. And as I said at the beginning of it, which you'll hear in just a few minutes, I think we're going to piss some people off today. But that's okay because sometimes it's necessary. But let me tell you who the guest is. His name is Ed Bermilla, and he is a political scientist. He's a PhD in political science, so Dr. Bermilla to you. He's got a new book out called Chaotic Neutral, and the subtitle reads, How the Democrats Lost Their Soul in the Center. And yeah, you know, he's like a kindred soul. He has the same problem with the Democratic Party I do, and wants to do a little bit of tough love on them. You know, I remember back in the day when I used to fill in for Randy Rhodes on her syndicated show, the show that was syndicated by Premier Radio, and some of her listeners just hated me because I was critical of the Obama administration. And the thing is, I am critical of the Democrats because they can do so much better. Obama should have been a great president, but frankly, he wasn't. And the Democrats, you know, I got to give Joe Biden some credit that he's pulling things back together after it all sort of fell apart on him. But the party still has some problems inherent. And we're going to get into it in this interview coming up in just a couple of minutes. So stick around for that. But before we get to that, there is some, you know, some news, some breaking news. I told you the other day I need a breaking news sounder. Well, it's not, it's this kind of broken news is more like it. Okay. Yeah, it's broken. All right. So the first bit of broken news today is, you know, the other day we were talking about that the Justice Department was again trying to fast track their appeal. And sure enough, the appeals court granted the Justice Department's motion to expedite the appeal of Judge Cannon's order appointing the special master to oversee the seized Mar-a-Lago documents. And now, so there was a response that came out today putting dates on when the first response has to come and then the response to the response and then the response to the response to the response. And anyway, they are expediting it. And again, I'm not a lawyer and I don't even pretend to play one on the radio, but it seems to me that this order did what their first order did in smacking down Judge Aileen, what's her last name? You know, Trump's handpicked, the judge she appointed that's there on a lifetime appointment, and she's just kind of nuts. Aileen Cannon. That's, how could I forget, Loose Cannon. Aileen Cannon. So it seems like the appeals court again put her in her place, but who knows? That whole thing is just so, so screwy. Now I've got three stories that we can separate. What? I know, I got it. You're behind. I said Cannon. The good, the bad, and the ugly, right? There was some good news. I guess that's the good news. The appeals court granted the DOJ motion to expedite the appeal of Judge Cannon's order. So that's good. The bad news is, let me back up before I get to the bad news, because it was good news before it turned bad. You do know that the price of gas fell for 99 straight days up until about a week ago. And then it sort of jerked up and down. Of course, the media, the corporate mainstream media, didn't report on that. You didn't hear the stories about gas prices falling for 99 days in a row until the falling trend, falling price trend ended. And then they're like, they're going up again. Yeah. But for 99 days in a row, they went down. Well, today, the OPEC Plus coalition said that they are going to cut production by 2 million barrels a day. Let me say that again. The Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, and its oil exporting allies announced a 2 million barrel per day cut in oil production, bucking months of pressure from Washington to increase production to bring the prices down. But what they want to do is spike the prices because, again, these are, these countries in OPEC, Saudi Arabia, they're Trump's buddies. They want to make things bad for Joe Biden and the Democrats as we go into Election Day. So let's see. This would be the first time OPEC cut oil production targets since the beginning of the pandemic. And I don't know who this group is who weighed in on it. But apparently Jeff Stein, Evan Halper, whoever these people. Oh, writers. I must be at maybe Politico or something. They say this move amounts to a rebuke to President Biden that could push up gas prices worldwide and worsen fears of a global recession. Lovely. Yeah. So again, this is going to essentially cut 2% of global oil supplies. And so in response, Biden he's been trying to keep this from happening. They did it anyway. It could benefit Russia by propping up the Kremlin's own petroleum revenues before the European Union sanctions are set to take effect in December. So there's that. Biden said he's going to release more from the national oil reserves. But, 2 million barrels a day, that's a lot to make up. A lot to make up. So expect the gas prices to rise again. Not because of anything you did or I did or Joe Biden did, but because of these OPEC countries who want to screw it, who want to screw us over again. So that's happening. And then there's the ugly. And I could have made the gas story the ugly and made this one the bad, but since I'm sort of addicted to Twitter, the ugly is Elon Musk is buying Twitter. Again, after all, probably. See, what he said was, Twitter threatened Elon Musk with a lawsuit for backing out of this deal that he made the overtures to purchase Twitter for a lot of money, like a lot of money. And then, he started playing coy and he backed off and he's like, there's a lot of spam bots and crap like that. And then, now he decided what he said yesterday was that he would go through with the deal as originally proposed as long as they drop the lawsuit. So basically, he doesn't want to go to court. God, I wonder why. Anyway, if Twitter drops the lawsuit, he said he'll purchase Twitter for, $54 a share or some ridiculous amount. Because I still don't know how you make money with Twitter. But it does provide a service as heinous as it could be sometimes, as upsetting as the platform could be. He's only going to make it worse. So, there's that. One other thing before we get to this interview. President Biden is in Florida today surveying touring the damaged, hurricane-damaged, ravaged areas on the west coast of the state. He's in Lee County in the Fort Myers area that took the direct hit. And yesterday, we saw a picture. of him, right, wearing his boots. Hold on, let me put this up on the screen. Let me get that off of there. So yeah, Ron DeSantis wearing his white galoshes, his like go-go boots. One of the things I love about Twitter and one of the things I love about the interwebs is people are so creative. So there are a few other photographs that surfaced. Oh, that's not the one I wanted. All right. Well, here's one. That's the second. Hold on. Let me see if I can find this other one first because somebody, this is it. Oh, okay. Okay. So there's the original one with his galoshes, the white galoshes. Somebody photoshopped it and extended the boots a little higher and gave them a pointy heel. So there's old moron death sentence wearing his thigh high white boots with pointy toes and high heels. I think they're called fuck me pumps, except they're not pumps. Fuck me heels, maybe? Fuck me boots? Ew. No, not him. And then, well, this one, I guess Ron was feeling a bit salty. So here's Ron in his boots and what appears to be like a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader outfit. You got to love it. The fun with Photoshop. Yeah, it's good stuff. But in all seriousness, hard to be serious with that picture on the screen. Okay, it's gone now. With that gone, I can play this sound. So it was interesting. Poor moron death sentence did everything he could to not say Joe Biden's name when he was praising the response, but he couldn't help it. So DeSantis almost praised the president.
They need more, and that's something that the president could obviously approve. Sometimes the bureaucracy can paralyze this, and I will say from local, state coordination, FEMA, there's been less bureaucracy holding us back in this one than probably anyone I've seen.
Less bureaucracy than with any other disaster I've seen. How about thank you, Mr. President? Because you're doing exactly what you said you would do, and you did not throw out a single roll of paper towels. Hey, credit where credit is due. All right. Ready for some tough love for the Democratic Party? See, again, I want you to remember as you listen to this interview that you're about to hear that I criticize because I care. I criticize because I know the Democratic Party can do so much better than they are doing. And I mean that on different fronts. Better for the country, better for the planet, better in terms of the job they're doing, better on all fronts, all right? So don't take this as me putting down the Democrats. And here's the other thing. By criticizing the Democratic Party and the way they operate, I'm by no means saying anything about the Republicans. One, in this case, has nothing to do with the other. This is simply an examination of the problems, or as our guest, Ed Bermilla says, it is the evolution or the devolution of the Democratic Party from the New Deal era to Biden's status quo candidacy and the pandemic when, he writes, even in the midst of a genuine national crisis, the Dems could not manage to pass sweeping progressive legislation. And that's where we begin. You ready? Okay. So let's try this. All right. This time it's going to work. All right. So here we go. Take it away, Nicole. I think we may piss off more than a few people today, but hey, sometimes that's necessary. My guest is Ed Bermilia, doctor, I presume, because you hold a PhD in political science. Ed has been teaching and writing about American politics for 20 years or so, spent 10 years as a professor, as a blogger and a podcaster, and has a new book out called Chaotic Neutral, How the Democrats Lost Their Soul in the Center. And I got to say, this book is a must read for everyone, especially frustrated progressives. And there are a lot of us out here. So, Ed, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I got to say, I wish I had started reading the book earlier, because I was both, you know, nodding my head furiously and laughing out loud at many places throughout the book. So thank you. It's a wonderful read.
Well, I'm glad that you're enjoying it. You know, my goal, first and foremost, whatever I'm writing about, is to make sure people enjoy reading it. You know, there's a lot of books out there that I think make points that are useful about the political process and understanding partisan politics and everything. But if they're dry and not very interesting to read, I don't think the message is going to get across to a very wide audience. So I'm glad you're enjoying it. That was certainly one of my goals when I was writing it, was to make sure people, even if it made them frustrated or angry, you know, didn't make them want to put the book down.
No.
Because they weren't getting anything out of it other than frustration, which, let's be honest, we can go online and frustrate ourselves easily, you know, following politics. So no need for more of that.
Exactly. The introduction. Sometimes people skip over the introduction of a book. Do not, because there's so much here. You like lay out the whole premise, the goals for the book. So what were the goals for the book?
I wanted to write a book that by the time people got to the end of it, they would have seen a fully fleshed out argument about why the Democratic Party, what it's been doing for the past couple decades, simply isn't working. Because that's really the precursor to things getting better or fixing it or improving it or coming up with a new strategy or whatever. You have to understand why what you've been doing is not working. And that's really the goal here with Chaotic Neutral. Some of the, you know, reviews and things people have told me after they've read the book, you know, they say it's not a book of fully fleshed out solutions and a blueprint for the future. I think I do some of that in the book, but that's, you know, valid criticism. My goal here wasn't to write the 10,000th book that's available, where you say, I've got it. Here's how we're going to fix the Democratic Party or whatever. Those books exist. What I wanted to do was to make sure that we could be arguing from the same premise. We could all be at the same starting line, which is to understand why what we've been doing isn't working. And until we can all agree on that, I don't think moving forward is going to be very easy, or we're going to be able to do it very successfully until we grasp here, look, this is what doesn't work. And we know it doesn't work because we've been doing it, and look at the results.
Right. And we know it doesn't work. Oh, look, the Democratic Party has spawned the phrase pulling defeat from the jaws of victory. And I don't know how many times I've said that over the last decade or more, but maybe as many times as the Democrats have done it. There were things that there should have been a shoo-in, and yet everything is a battle, right? Even now, I mean, we're looking at a Republican Party that wants to bring this country back to the 50s and further back. They want to take away women's...
The 1850s, I believe.
Right, really? And, I mean, it should be a no-brainer. You have candidates like Herschel Walker and Dr. Oz. Again, and Herschel Walker against, I think, one of the most eloquent, smartest, articulate, great senators in Raphael Warnock. And it's neck and neck. And now we learn that he paid for an abortion when he's screaming about, you know, no exceptions for rape and incest. And it's still an uphill battle for the Democrats to win that seat. It's every time you turn around, nothing makes sense. Maybe it starts with the leadership, the Democratic Party. You know, we could talk about Jamie Harrison or Tom Perez.
He's very good at raising money. And, and that, I think, has a very, that counts for a lot in terms of putting people in leadership positions. You know, national party leadership at this point is seen, right or wrong, probably wrong, as is generally, you know, largely a fundraising position. Mm-hmm. So Harrison is good at that. I think that made him appealing to a lot of people in the party. They saw how much money he raised when he ran for Senate unsuccessfully in 2020. And they figured, hey, let's put this guy's skill to the best possible use. And, you know, certainly fundraising is not lagging.
That's not been a problem. I mean, some years are better than others. But again, the money is not the, maybe money is the issue. Maybe we need to get rid of the emphasis on money, get money out of politics. But that's something that the Democrats didn't do when they had the power to do it.
Well, the interest in campaign finance reform waned in the 2000s when Democrats got much better at raising money. And then in 2008 with Obama, for the first time, they had a presidential election where they just blew the Republicans out of the water in terms of fundraising. So I think it's predictable to some extent that when the gap closes, and by some estimates now, Democrats are doing an even better job of raising money than you know, Republicans are. The interest in reforming the system is, you know, inversely proportional to, you know, how well you're doing at raising money. And now that they've gotten much better at it, the incentive to dial it back is, you know, less than it was. But I think that one of the things that they can take away from 2018 and 2020 that they don't seem to be taking away from it is there's a limited marginal benefit from raising more money beyond a certain point. You know, a Senate campaign is considered extremely well-funded once it raises a certain amount of money, and everything above that is just going to be wasted on advertising, you know, and the marginal effect of people seeing a Facebook ad for Sherry Beasley here in North Carolina 75 times as opposed to 70. You know, there's very little argument that that money is actually being well spent at that point. Mm-hmm. So campaigns for, you know, some of the leading Senate campaigns are going to end up raising nine figures in this cycle. Val Demings will probably raise nine figures. The question is that a solution to anything?
And no.
I think people like Chuck Schumer look at it as this is panacea. If people can raise these enormous amounts of money, that gives them a better chance to win. And, you know, certainly you want to have money rather than not have it when you're running a campaign, but simply putting, you know, $100 million or $120 million behind a Senate candidate doesn't necessarily add or give you a benefit that you're not going to get from spending $40 or $50 million for that Senate race, right? Which is still an exorbitant amount of money.
It's obscene. And actually, I am in Florida, so I'm seeing the ads. And I'll tell you something, as much money as Val Demings has raised, and she's up on TV. Florida's a tough market because there are so many media markets because it's a big, long state. However, the Republican Party of Florida has to be spending a fortune on ads for DeSantis, because every time there's a commercial break, I don't care what channel is on, there's one of these ads paid for by the Republican Party of Florida that are just attacks on Charlie Crist. I mean, enough already. And if you think money is the answer to the question, then maybe, you know, you get what you deserve.
You're asking the wrong question.
Exactly. Exactly. So Ed Bermilla, in the introduction again, you lay out, you say, you identify and draw out the specific things that Democrats get wrong, the mistakes they're making over and over again. You call them the eight pathologies. Should we go through what they are? Because every one of them you can recognize. The first one, excessive ideological flexibility. Boy, they don't.
We saw some of this recently. I think with. Oh, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
That's okay. I was just saying they're not firm on anything. They remind me of the you know, those wind things that go outside of the car dealers that flop back and forth.
Yeah. Wacky waving inflatable tube
yes,
man.
Exactly.
I think we saw some of this over the past few months, you know, the national House leadership flocking to Texas to help save Henry Cuellar, you know, in his primary campaign. And one of the arguments I heard Jim Clyburn making is, you know, it's so good to have ideological diversity within the Democratic caucus. And from the perspective of you know, a party in government. That's actually not what you want at all. You want everybody being able to be relied upon and being able to count upon every member of the caucus to pull the rope in the same direction at the same time on certain things. You know, and if you can't get a basic commitment to some Democratic Party goals out of, you know, having somebody like Henry Cuellar doesn't actually accomplish a whole lot for you. They think it does because they, you know, the way they envision it is all that matters is that we get plus one person who gets us closer to having the majority. And the way they should be thinking about it, and what I argue in the book, is if you can't put together a coalition of people who can govern because they agree on basic things, winning the majority with people like Sinema or Cuellar isn't going to avail you of much, and you're not going to be able to hold on to the majority for very long if the people who make up your majority are not all willing to help you govern. Right. They decry the idea of litmus tests all the time. Oh, we can't have these purity tests ruining liberal politics. Well, you know, Sinema fails one of the basic litmus tests, which is, are you going to help us govern? Should we govern when we have the majority? And if your answer to that is no, then, you know, I think there's that severely undercuts the argument that all that matters, you know, a vote blue, no matter who, nominate whoever you think you can get to win. And then once you get into the majority, power will figure itself out. And you have to be thinking, like, are we going to be able to govern with these people? One of the examples I harp on in Chaotic Neutral is, you know, Rahm Emanuel's rise in 2006 to boy genius of the Democratic Party, because he managed to, you know, oversee a house, you know, taking back the House in an election where George W. Bush's approval rating, you know, the incumbent president, was at like 27%. But, you know, Emanuel's boasting about how he put together all these pro-gun, pro-life conservative Democrats and everything. And then you saw between 2008 and 2010, after Obama was elected, how difficult it was to get that Democratic House majority to go along with the president's priorities.
Right.
You know,
right.
You can't simply be thinking of it in the perspective of, well, look, we'll nominate right wingers and call them Democrats, you know, whatever it takes to win the majority. Having the majority is great. Being able to govern with it and hold on to it because you governed effectively and that resonated with people is more important.
Right. And then to continue with the Henry Cuellar thing, this support for him, where the entire leadership went to Texas to campaign for him in a primary, by the way, against a progressive challenger who was this close to beating him. So their support may have made the difference. This comes right as the Supreme Court is overturning Roe v. Wade, and he is the only anti-choice so-called Democrat in the House. Talk about mixed signals. They can't get it straight. No, we're the pro-choice party.
Yeah, I think in the wake of the Dobbs decision, you saw about a month of them kind of spinning their wheels, trying to figure out, all right, what's our response to this? And there is, you know, an immediate sense that, yes, we should push back against this. Dobbs is going to be a great fulcrum that Democrats can use to start pushing back against this, you know, wildly conservative Republican Party. But at the same time, there is that impulse that they have developed and, you know, very keenly over the last 30 years of, well, let's make sure we don't alienate any moderates, right? We don't want to talk about abortion too much because there's this hypothetical voter out there who realizes Republican Party is fascist, but is totally happy to vote for the fascists if the Democratic Party doesn't, you know, adopt these sort of, well, maybe positions on everything. And I think the unpopularity of the Dobbs decision is, if anything, a strong argument to simply go for it on abortion and bang this drum constantly and say, look, the Republicans are trying to take this right away. Not, yes. Well, we want to make sure that if you are pro-life or anti-abortion, you know, you feel perfectly comfortable with whoever the Democrats put up there. You know, sometimes you just got to pick a side, and this attempt to waffle everything is ultimately unsuccessful. It just makes you look like you don't have any convictions. You know, right. The metaphor I use in one of the chapters about Bill Clinton is, you know, the nervous wedding caterer who's just desperate to win, you know, your business because he doesn't have anything going on. You know, he says, okay, how about this? Oh, no, if you don't like that, how about this instead? Oh, don't worry. We can have white wine. We can have red wine, whatever you want. You know, there's no core to what he's trying to do. He's just trying to be obsequious and win your approval by asking you what you want and then trying to follow up with it. And that strategy, I think, has very clear limits where, you know, people who want to see the Democratic Party solidly stand up for and fight for certain principles that are important to them feel like everything is negotiable.
Yeah,
right. And right. Everything can't, most things can be negotiable. It's politics, but everything can't be negotiable. There have to be some core principles. And maybe it's time in the wake of the Dobbs decision for the national leadership to simply embrace, look, we are the pro bodily autonomy and reproductive rights party. If you're not, I'm sorry, maybe we're not going to appeal to you on that specific issue.
Right.
You can't constantly be waffling. Something has to be the line in the sand where you say, okay, this is one of us and this is not what we stand for.
Right. I mean, Democrats should have a clear ownership of bodily autonomy, for instance, of the party that is not imposing our beliefs on anyone else at a time when the Republicans are bearing down more than ever. But yet Ron Johnson, one of the more reprehensible members of the, you know, Republican senatorial caucus, is able to make a statement like this yesterday.
We're conservative, so we really are the live and let live party. Yeah, I really don't care what you do. I really, as long as you're not infringing on somebody else's freedom, as long as you're not harming somebody else, I mean, you go live your life and that's fine. I'm not going to impose the way I live my life on somebody else, but that is, you're exactly right. That is what the left does, which is what is so annoying about the left. You know, it's far worse than annoying, but they've got to shove everything down your throat.
They've got to shove everything down your throat. Now, obviously, this is part of the opposite world that I'm always talking about, but he can get away with saying stuff like that because the Democrats can be wishy-washy. And you go there. I mean, you mentioned Bill Clinton, and he gets a lot of your ire. Do you think the Democratic Party became this wishy-washy thing under him? Did it really start with him, or was it before?
The historical record lays out pretty clearly, you know, the ways the Democratic Party changed in the 1990s, and Bill Clinton and his ideological allies in the Democratic Leadership Council had been making this argument for about 10 years before Clinton entered the White House, that the way the Democratic Party was going to be able to get back on top was to essentially concede that Republicans were right about these issues like crime and air quotes welfare and, you know, national defense, which Democrats, you know, were sick of being labeled soft on or whatever. So they were going to move and embrace some of the Republican positions on these issues, argue that they were putting their own little unique Democratic spin on them, but essentially kind of yield and say, yeah, you know, the conservatives are right. Welfare is bad and we need to end it, you know.
And he kind of did, right? Bill Clinton did.
And the way that that is rationalized to liberal voters is, hey, look, you know, we're giving in on this point, but we're going to do it in a way that is smarter and better than the Republicans would do it. The Republicans are troglodytes and they'll simply say, OK, no more welfare. We'll kick everyone off it. Democratic, you know, brand will be, we'll take this, what is essentially a right wing approach to dismantling the social welfare state, but we'll come up with some formulas and some white papers and, you know, a complicated bureaucratic program of explaining how this is going to be phased out and who will still be eligible for it. So the idea of doing what the Republicans want, but doing it better or smarter, I think it traces pretty clearly to Clinton. We saw it again in 2004, where John Kerry's attempted presidential campaign message was essentially, well, yeah, you know, the war on terror is great, but, you know, Bush can't be trusted to do it correctly. The Democrats are smarter. We'll do it better. We'll have, you know, more efficient conduct of, you know, the war on terrorism or whatever. So this argument that yields or cedes the point ground to the Republican Party and says, yeah, you're right about this, but then tries to convince voters, but we'll do it better. You know, ultimately, that's been a something that Democrats have tried to exploit for short-term gain, mm-hmm. which Clinton did in, you know, during his presidency. But the long-term impact of that is essentially, well, you told conservatives that they're right about these issues and you essentially yielded. Of course, they're going to go on the attack now.
Right. So again, Ed Bermilib, going back to your eight pathologies, the core of why Dems are their own worst enemy, I'm going to jump around a bit. One of them is constantly trying to impress Republicans. They don't have that issue. They don't do it. They don't try to impress us. They outwardly say, you're the enemy. But the And I'm not saying that's the right way to go, but the Democrats bend over backwards. So, come on in. We're a big tent. We represent.
I mean, there was the first night of Joe Biden's nominating convention in 2020 was devoted entirely to Bush, George W. Bush era Republican apostates, you know. I think there's good reason to wonder how many votes that really won. You know, it's impossible to draw a direct line between something that happens at a convention, which, let's be honest, is mostly just entertainment for the party faithful. Most people don't remember much if they pay any attention to it at all. But, you know, just the imagery of telling your own party base, well, look, one of these nights at the convention, we need to devote to letting people from the other party come up here and talk about how, you know, how they've seen the light and the Republican Party is evil and now they're Democratic supporters or whatever. It's very, very questionable, I think, how much that's really appealing to anyone who isn't already going to be voting for, you know, Democratic presidential candidates.
Without a doubt.
And as you point out, there's zero pushback or there's zero reciprocity on that from the Republican Party, you know?
Right.
They would get laughed out of the convention hall if they stood up there and said, well, we're going to do a whole night that's all Democrats because we really need to make sure the Democratic voters out there don't think we're too extreme and we want them to know we're open and friendly or whatever. You know, they entirely punt on that and the electoral consequences for them haven't materialized yet. You know, they're for a lot of reasons, they're still able to be highly competitive in elections, no matter how terrible and how extreme their candidates are.
It is astounding. Joe Biden finally goes on the attack and calls out the MAGA Republicans, making sure to specify it's only a certain portion of them, but those people are really, really bad. And the Republicans respond by saying that is the most divisive attack I have heard any president ever make when we just finished 4 years of Donald Trump calling us and the media the enemy of the people. If you're a Democrat, you are an enemy, and we are here to destroy you. But yet, Joe Biden is the most divisive. We let them control the narrative all the time, or they do, right?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it is the, you know, mainstream media outlets have largely been browbeaten over the decades into this idea that, well, we can't be too critical of the Republicans because then we're losing objectivity. We need to make sure we are not susceptible to these charges of media bias. And one of the things that, you know, the learning curve is just not, you know, they're not picking up on fast enough is the idea that there is no amount of white glove treatment you can give the Republican Party that will get them to stop accusing you of liberal media bias, right? Because the accusation of liberal media bias is so central to the Republican worldview. And it has been since long before modern politics. I mean, Spiro Agnew was beating that drum in the 1960s and making a national political profile, you know, for himself based on railing about the liberal East Coast media or whatever, you know, which also has some anti-Semitic coding in it. But it's just such a fundamental part of the Republican worldview that nothing the New York Times does, no matter how many goofy right-wing columnists they hire, no matter how many things about cancel culture they run, the New York Times being air quotes a liberal rag is always going to be central to the conservative worldview. It's just a part of their cosmology, and it doesn't respond to reality.
Exactly. Another one of the pathologies you point out, and this one, God, gets me every time, failure or refusal to learn from mistakes. Oh my God. You know, we make mistakes, learn from them, but they keep repeating them over and over again.
the Biden administration has done a little bit of a I don't want to say they've done a great job. I think they've learned a couple of things from the Obama experience. It's sad that it took 8 years of Obama for, you know, to get through, you know, to finally convince some people in leadership positions in the party. Hey, look, the Republicans don't really want to negotiate with us in good faith in Congress. All they're doing is drawing this stuff out so they can build up opposition to it and ultimately stonewall legislation. So the Biden administration has done a couple of things. You know, they finally realize that the only way they're going to pass legislation is through reconciliation, because you're never going to get 10 Republican votes in the Senate unless, as with some of the infrastructure stuff, you essentially let the Republicans write the bill and take out whatever they want, which happened to me with most of the, you know, most beneficial parts of it. But, so there is a little bit of a learning curve. But every once in a while, I think the old Democratic Party kind of raises its, you know, it's still there in their psyche. You know, they have a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other. And, you know, the angel is telling them, just do it, do reconciliation. That's the only way you're going to get bills through. But then on the other shoulder, you have the, you know, the ghost of Joe Lieberman, who I know he's still alive, but let's imagine his ghost is there. Yeah, and telling him, no, right. That's not the right way to do it. You need to get some Republican buy-in, you know, and you hear that from cinema all the time. Well, you know, unless it's bipartisan, we can't have voting.
Right.
Nobody wants bills to be bipartisan. They want them to be good. You know, the question for the legislation is this necessary for the survival of the republic? Is this good for the country? And do Americans, broadly speaking, support it? That's a good definition of bipartisanship, right?
Yes,
if 70
yes.
or 80% of the public supports something, there's bipartisan support for it. Waiting until, you know, this magical, mythical, never going to happen revelation, you know, where 10, 12 Republicans in the Senate just start playing along, that's not bipartisan. That's playing into legislative obstruction. And, you know, at times the Biden administration has indicated that they get that. At other times we've gone through the, you know, Lucy and the football cycle again.
Over and over again. I mean, the yeah. thing they should have learned from was the fight over Obamacare. I was on the air back then, and I remember they went through, they took great pains to bring the Republicans in. They wrote it in three different committees, and Republicans kept saying they passed it in the dead of night. Bullshit. They did this. They debated it incessantly and went in three committees and rewrote it and gave the Republicans all these amendments. And they, you know, we lost the public option. We lost all these things that should have been in it. And then the Republicans didn't vote for it in the final bill anyway. But
I think they got three, right? They got three Republican votes. And the point is, what did that gain? You know,
nothing.
How long would you and I have to go stand on a street corner asking strangers, hey, how many Republicans are, you know, was it a bipartisan vote to pass the ACA or whatever? First of all, nobody knows. And second of all, nobody really cares. You know, if the law passed, it passed. If it didn't, it didn't, you know, and ultimately the bending over backwards that the Obama White House did to get a couple of Republicans to kind of grudgingly, you know, agree not to obstruct it was, you know, the political payoff for that was essentially nil.
Right, right. But you point out the other seminal moment that the Democrats should have learned from on page two of the book. That's when I'm like, to my husband, oh my God, you got to hear this. And I'm reading him paragraphs. So let me share this one. You talk about two important moments that you experienced that showed you what the main problems were with this Democratic Party. And you wrote, the first is the moment of realization that what passes for liberal in the United States is closer to the political center by any meaningful definition of the term. For me, that moment was spread out across 2009 when Barack Obama, backed by a near supermajority in Congress, let Wall Street's masters of the universe off with a slap on the wrist as punishment for shit-canning the global economy, then insisted they get the bonuses he previously described as shameful, then concern trolled about the deficit on a financial stimulus that was too small and far too weighted toward tax cuts, then did worse than nothing to help the millions of Americans who were facing foreclosure. I lived through this. So many of us did. And yes, the fact that, and look, I'm no no economics master or anything, but I was a homeowner at the time who lost my home in that meltdown there. And all I saw was our government giving tons of money to the banks when they could have siphoned it through the homeowners with the provision that it goes to pay down the mortgage. The bankers would get the money in the long run, but it would have given relief to those millions of us struggling and losing our homes. And they didn't learn. They learned nothing.
I think one thing that passage really proves is how prone I am to run on sentences. So thanks for sticking with that till the end. Second, I'm sorry to hear about your experience with foreclosure. But one of the big problems with the Obama administration is they had this kind of messianic campaign where it suggested he was going to be this pivot point, a historical agent of change or whatever. He really didn't have any desire to govern that way. And there's a kind of liberal historiography about how, well, he wanted to, but he just couldn't. And I think the farther we get from the Obama presidency and the more we see sort of who he really is politically when he emerges periodically from, you know, podcasting with Bruce Springsteen to, you know, comment on the state of national affairs. This really is who he is. He's cautious. He did the things that he did because those reflected his true preferences. And it just drives me crazy to hear this constant embrace of this historiography of him as the thwarted messiah. You know, I think there's a very good and clear argument, especially if you read his voluminous, biography or memoir of his time as president. He got what his preferences were. You know, what we saw from the Obama presidency is very close to what Barack Obama's true revealed preferences are politically.
There's also this romanticism about him within the party. Boy, people get angry when I criticize him, but I have to if I'm going to be honest. I criticize because I love and because I care and because I want this country to be what it should be, not what it's become. And with Obama, I mean, Can someone stand up and say he left us without a bench? He left the Democratic Party hurting in each state where the state legislatures were controlled by the Republicans. He really did not leave the party in any kind of shape to defend against the Donald Trump or this rise of fascism that's now upon us.
Now, he's made several comments in recent years that I think are really revealing and kind of head scratching about how, well, I just didn't foresee the Republicans being, you know, what they've become today. Or I thought the institutional guardrails were enough to stop them from becoming what they've become today or whatever. And look, man, he was there. He was president. He's obviously accomplished way more in life. He's not asking for Ed Bermilla's opinion about anything. But if you could live through the reaction that we saw in 2009 and 10, the Tea Party Republican stuff, the he's not born here stuff and everything. Right. If you could personally be the target of all of that and not quite realize, hey, wait, I think the Republican Party is turning into something kind of deranged and might not be our reasonable, you know, responsible partners in governing or whatever. I don't know what to tell you. If it really took him until 2010, or I'm sorry, till 2020, you know, to sort of realize, oh, wait, these people are crazy and they can't be negotiated with, that's on him. That's a failure on his part to pick up on something that, you know, far be it for me to say, but probably should have been pretty obvious to someone in his position by the time he, you know, spent his first year in the White House at the very least.
Right. And Joe Biden, having been there for 8 years of seeing his boss constantly make, you know, overtures to the Republicans only to have them knocked down and, you know, kind of shit all over him. You would think that Joe Biden would have come in and said, I've learned from that lesson, but he didn't. He's like, I'm going to govern for everybody. And what? Oh, please. Here we go again. They'll work with me. No, they won't. So what's the answer? There's a clip I love playing. It's Joe Manchin saying, well, elect more liberals. Yeah. But don't we need to give them a reason to elect more liberals?
Yeah, I mean, the one of the fundamental things behind the motivation to write this book and what Chaotic Neutral is really about is this sense that Democrats look at the problem of losing elections the wrong way. They lose an election or they don't do as well as they hope, and they immediately turn all of the magnifying glasses outward and start looking for who can we blame for this? Whose fault is this? And it's voters are stupid. Voters are, they let themselves be lied to because they lack sophistication, which is just another way of saying they're stupid. The Republicans are cheating and tilting the playing field and everything. All of these things may have a kernel of truth to them. We know people aren't terribly well informed about politics. We know a lot of Americans have racist and sexist the kinds of attitudes that we find repellent about, different political issues. But the question they need to be asking themselves, and this was a key point that Democratic Leadership Council moderates made in the 80s when they were arguing against the party elite's sort of incorrect view of the world, was we need to ask, what did we do wrong? How did we screw this up? What did we fail to do to convince more people to vote for us, right? And until their sort of post-election schema of understanding politics defaults to that question, they're going to continue to have problems, right? The liberal knee jerk when an election doesn't go as well as they thought is to immediately start looking for who to blame. Right. Who let us down? Who failed us? Who was so dumb that they failed to understand how great we are and vote for us? When the question should be, the core of electoral politics is convince people to vote for you. And if you're not convincing people to vote for you in sufficient numbers, you have to reevaluate what you're doing and say, what can we do differently? How did we fail to reach these voters last time and won't fail to reach them this time? What is it they want to hear that we're not telling them? If they have misimpressions and misinformation, of course they do. We live in a cacophonous and, information environment where nobody, even when they set out to find, good, reliable information, in fact, you have a hard time finding it, right? So what the Democratic Party's default response to elections that don't go as well as they hope they would go needs to be, what can we do differently? What did we do wrong? Not this litany of complaining about, when your team loses the Super Bowl and you just whine about the referees or something like that. Yeah, maybe the referees made some bad calls. That's entirely possible. But the ultimate point is you lost and next time you want to win. What are you going to do differently and better to win as opposed to experiencing the same outcome again?
That we could go on for hours. And believe me, I do every day. This is the kind of stuff I spew about because it infuriates me because they don't learn from their mistakes. They're not, you told the story of Chuck Schumer and how what his criteria is that he considers this family, this middle class. Oh my God. Go ahead.
Now he literally, he's open about the fact that he has created an imaginary pair of old white moderates who live in his head, and he thinks politics is trying to cater to what they want. And that, Schumer may have some sort of strengths that I'm not aware of, but, Pelosi gets criticism and, Pelosi defenders can at least point to a few things she's done as speaker and go, oh yeah, okay. She fought back against the Medicaid thing in 2005. That's great. Schumer, I don't know what the point of that guy is. Like, what has he ever done or ever accomplished that you can point to and say, he's doing a good job as leader. But regardless of that, the idea that he thinks politics is imagining two old white people and then based on his own psyche, like trying to give them what he thinks they want. It's just insane. Politics is convincing more people to vote for you than they're, willing to vote for the other party. That's the core of it. Not imagining a kind of person you want to be voting for you and then psychologically imagining a way you satisfy them.
Right.
It's just so wrong. And it's such a bizarre way to look at it that that's the point of Chaotic Neutral, is we need to go back and re-examine the most basic things about their worldview of how electoral politics works, because they're not working well enough.
Not at all. And then we need to get the right people in place who understand the principles that the things, the common sense things that you're saying here. The book is Chaotic Neutral, How the Democrats Lost Their Soul in the Center. Ed Bermilla, you can find him on Twitter at Ed Bermilla. Your podcast is Mass for Shut-ins, which I love that. And your mostly dormant blog is at ginandtacos.com.
That's correct. The art of blogging is kind of dying out. Social media has killed it off. And plus, I just have too much other writing I'm getting paid to do to devote a lot of time to free writing on the blog anymore. If anybody recognizes me, that is probably where they're going to recognize me from.
Well, it was great to meet you again. You're verbalizing what swims through my head all the time. And again, you should. My husband last night kept going, wait, you got to hear this. Listen to this. So I'm sharing a lot of it with him. The book is wonderful. It's not only you make great points, but it is very readable and it's humorous. And yes, I laughed out loud many, many times so far. And I look forward
That's
to finishing it.
That's kind of you
it.
To say.
Ed, it was great meeting you. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. I hope you'll come back.
No problem. Have me on anytime. Thank you.
Terrific. And I will. Oh, hold on. I got to fix the microphone. Just like that. Okay. And I will certainly invite him back on because wow. He's great. And the book, let me tell you something. You know, I get a lot of books. I talk to a lot of authors because you know, I get pitched on them, and believe me, I turn down many more than I take. But when I read the blurb about this book, I thought it's the tough love thing we need to get to. But I wasn't kidding when I said, and yes, it is on audio, I'm sure. But you know, the passages I kept stopping during dinner and saying, "Oh my God, listen to this." So let me share this with you. He talks about. You know, I mentioned the first moment that the passage that I read about how nothing happened. We didn't learn from the mistake of bailing out the banks in 2008 and not helping, you know, the struggling homeowners and all that. But he said the second moment is the brutal one. Let me just share this passage with you because it's brilliant. It's the moment you realize that there is something deeply wrong with these people. They're not merely a little too eager to compromise, too moderate, or too trusting of Republicans who radiate maliciousness. Those things may be true, but the problems run far deeper. The way they see politics and the political world are, in a word, broken. For me, this moment can be dated precisely February 28th, 2017, around 10 p.m. President Trump had just delivered his first speech to a joint session of Congress, one of many occasions early in his presidency on which desperate pundits try to convince themselves that the moment he became president, he would start acting like an adult with object permanence. Oops. The Democratic response, always a thankless task for the minority party, was delivered by former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear. Now, I got to say, I have no memory of this moment at all, probably because I never pay attention to the responses to the State of the Union. But when I read how he recounts that moment, I'm just shocked, but not shocked, disappointed. Anyway, back to it. He writes, "Can you picture it, reader? Do you remember the visual that one commenter described as Jimmy Dean in a haunted diner? Do you remember the darkened room, the white audience, variously described as mannequins or hostages, as people instructed to freeze all motor functions for what looked like a reverse mortgage commercial? It looked terrible. Somehow the words were even worse." And then he quotes Steve Beshear. "I'm here in Lexington, Kentucky, some 400 miles from Washington, at a diner with some neighbors, Democrats and Republicans, where we just watched the president's address. I'm a proud Democrat, but first and foremost, I'm a proud Republican and Democrat and mostly American." Now it's back to Ed. He says, Let's think about this for a second. Donald Trump has just been elected president over Hillary Clinton, who Democrats broadly believe to be both a shoo-in and the most qualified candidate ever. The obvious heir to the legacy of moderate liberalism embodied in Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. She lost to a sentient Twitter account, a complete imbecile, a shamelessly self-promoting C-list celebrity, the avatar of every American yearning for someone to tell them it's okay to be a narcissistic prick because there are no consequences, or shouldn't be. A man who quite possibly has never read a book to conclusion in his life. You see what I mean about the way he writes? Trump's election was an existential threat to the country and to the Democratic Party. It wasn't a wake-up call. It was, wake up! In caps, that's my interpretation of all caps, engraved on a giant cartoon mallet that walloped Democrats in the face. Beautiful, right? And this was what the Democratic powers that be, and still are, concocted. This was what they chose to do with their first big symbolic chance to show America that they weren't the sad sack team in Air Bud that just lost a basketball game to a fucking dog. This was the way they thought they could inspire their emotionally shattered base and win over a country full of people grappling with the prospect of 4 years of President Father Coughlin. And then there's, you know, he's got notes on the bottom of pages. So if you don't know who Father Coughlin was or is, he has a footnote there. Charles Edward Coughlin, a Canadian-American Roman Catholic priest, had a weekly radio show in the 1930s, initially a big supporter of FDR and the New Deal. Father Coughlin turned against FDR and used his show to broadcast anti-Semitic commentary. He was a supporter of the fascist policies of Hitler, Mussolini, and Emperor Hirohito. You know, it goes like that. So, yes, I highly recommend the book. Yeah. So, anyway, with that, we've already run into overtime. So, here we are. Yeah, thank you for listening, everybody. It's written like that. So it's cutting. It is acerbic. It's funny. But most importantly, he is spot on. So that's why I have authors on. Sometimes they're not this great, but this guy was really good. All right. So that's it. Done for today. Tomorrow is Thursday. I'm going for a mammogram in the morning. And ladies, an old dear friend of mine, I learned yesterday, has stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. She fought breast cancer about 2 years ago. Sorry. She went through the chemo and the radiation, and she came out and was clean for a little while. And then something was up, and I didn't get all the details, but she had to have a what they call a liquid biopsy, because it wasn't like there was another mass in her breast. They were afraid it had spread, and it did. And so they caught it with this liquid biopsy, stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. So if you're a woman in my age group, get one every year. I'm going tomorrow morning. But tomorrow afternoon, Howie Klein will be here. And So there's that. All right. Just looking ahead, Friday, Greg Palast will be here. And Monday, Marcy Wheeler returns. All right. So you got that to look forward to. All right. I'm going to go. I'm going to leave you with the news. And we'll adjourn until tomorrow. And I'll thank you for listening. And thank you for supporting this program. Okay. See, and again, it wasn't bashing. Thank you. Kimchi, I know you were a bit worried. I know people who just don't want to hear any criticism. I think it's imperative. I think it's important that we criticize, not do it in a whiny, no solution kind of way, but tough love is sometimes necessary, and I think it's really necessary now. All right, with that, we're done. I'm deciding whether or not to give you our show card up while the news is playing, or some of these photos of Ron DeSantis, maybe both. All right. I'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Thanks again. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The death toll in the United States from Hurricane Ian rose to at least 109 on Tuesday as rescue crews continue going door to door in hard-hit communities in Southwest Florida looking for survivors. President Biden traveling to Lee County on Wednesday to meet with victims there and tour damaged areas. And yes, there will be a meeting between the president, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, along with a FEMA administrator and state and local officials. Biden and DeSantis are not expected to discuss their recent clash over DeSantis's stunt transferring migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre saying now is not the time. Then again, you never know what idiotic thing Ron DeSantis will say. Like this, just yesterday. I think he was talking about the media, but with DeSantis, you never really know.
Frankly, you know, you have national regime media that they wanted to see Tampa because they thought that that'd be worse for Florida. That's how these people think. I mean, they don't care about the people of this state. They don't care about the people of this community. They want to use storms and destruction from storms as a way to advance their agenda. And they don't care what destruction's in their wake. They don't care about the lives here. If they can use it to pursue their political agenda, they will do it.
Yeah, say that to Biden, see where it gets you, DeSantis. Anyway, the attorney representing the failed, twice impeached former president on Tuesday asked the Supreme Court to intervene in the dispute over classified documents seized by the FBI on August 8th when they searched Trump's Mar-a-Lago club in Florida. Now, Trump's team isn't asking the court to reverse the appeals court decision to let the Justice Department access those 100 documents that were marked as classified, but they're arguing that the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals was wrong to prevent the special master from reviewing the presumptively classified material, saying that Judge Deary's independent review is needed to determine whether the material is, quote, in fact classified. The thing is, it's the executive branch, not the judicial branch, that usually controls classification status. This is just a stalling tactic that, in this case, appears to be working. Another strategy employed by the Republicans is embracing the worst they have to offer. And that continues as the former guy and other powerful Republicans rally behind Georgia Republican Senate nominee Herschel Walker, in the wake of a report that he paid for a girlfriend's abortion in 2009. Walker, who claims he supports an abortion ban with no exceptions, has called the Daily Beast report a, quote, flat-out lie. But that's what they do. Trump said Walker's word is good enough for him. Of course it is. Walker said that he'd file a defamation lawsuit against the Daily Beast the following morning. Well, that would have been Tuesday. And still no sign of a lawsuit by Herschel Walker. And the really unbelievable part of this story is that this report comes as Walker had a recent surge in the polls, bringing him almost neck and neck with the incumbent, Senator Raphael Warnock. Inconceivable. In other inconceivable news, Michigan Judge Elizabeth Kelly on Tuesday threw out felony charges against 7 people over the Flint water scandal. 2 of the defendants were former state health officials blamed for deaths from Legionnaire's disease. The judge's decision came 3 months after the Michigan Supreme Court signaled that the charges probably wouldn't stick because the one judge grand jury that issued the indictments apparently lacked the authority to do so. The state attorney general's office asked the judge to refer the cases to Flint District Court to be treated as typical criminal complaints, but she, the judge, rejected the proposal. She said, quote, anything arising out of the invalid indictments are irreconcilably tainted from inception. Simply put, there are no valid charges. Sounds to me like Elizabeth Kelly is not a valid judge and should be removed from her post. What up, Michigan? Boy, we're filled with WTF stories today. Like this one, Elon Musk is back. In a major reversal, the billionaire is now proposing to buy Twitter at the full price he first floated after attempting to terminate the $44 billion acquisition agreement, which the company then sued him to complete. Well, according to a securities filing on Tuesday, Musk said he would follow through with the deal at the originally agreed upon price of $54.20 per share, as long as the lawsuit was withdrawn. Twitter stock was halted twice on Tuesday when news of the filing was first reported. And then after it resumed trading, it was up more than 20%, topping $51 a share and approaching the agreed upon deal price for the first time in months. Twitter confirmed it had received the letter and said it will go through with the deal, leaving many of us to think, well, Twitter, it was nice knowing you. Where to now? Stay tuned. For those who care, New York Yankees slugger Aaron Judge made baseball history on Tuesday with his 62nd home run of the season. That's an American League record. He blasted past the 1961 record of 61 home runs set by fellow Yankee Roger Maris. And a bit of sad news. Legendary country singer Loretta Lynn, the coal miner's daughter, died Tuesday at her home in Tennessee. Loretta Lynn's biggest hits were Coal Miner's Daughter, You Ain't Woman Enough, Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' with Lovin' on Your Mind. And Loretta Lynn changed a lot of attitudes back in 1975 with her song, The Pill.
There's gonna be some changes made right here on Nursery Hill. You set this chicken your last time, 'cause now I've got the pill.
It was an ode to birth control and probably the most famous song ever written about the ongoing fight for a woman's bodily autonomy. Loretta Lynn was 90.
Yeah, I'm making it for all those years since I've got the pill.
And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.